Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, Sir Keir Starmer is in Washington today, and at the top of his agenda is the war in Ukraine. The government want assurances that the US will continue to defend Ukraine from future Russian aggression, but the US are yet to commit to this. We'll discuss what a successful visit to Washington might look like for the Prime Minister as he walks into the belly of the beast.
We'll also speak about Andrew Tate, everybody's least favourite human, who is currently flying back from detention in Romania to the US amid a multitude of sexual assault and human trafficking allegations. The UK government has previously requested his extradition. Just how dangerous is this man to impressionable young men, and what message does his return send to people?
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, all that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first is The Week Unwrapped.
Today I've decided that we will fund the initial increase in defence spending by cutting our spending on overseas development, moving from 0.5% of GNI to 0.3%. I want to be clear, that is not an announcement that I'm happy to make. I'm proud of Britain's pioneering record on overseas development, and we will continue to play a key humanitarian role in war-torn countries like Sudan, Ukraine, and Gaza, in tackling climate change and supporting international efforts on global health challenges like vaccination. And we will do everything to move towards a world where we can rebuild our development capacity. However, the realities of our dangerous new era mean that the defence and national security of our country must always come first. That is what I campaigned on in the general election. It is what we are delivering today, a new approach on defence.
Sir Keir Starmer has set out plans to increase defence spending to 2.5% of national income. He told a packed House of Commons that this would mean spending £13.4 billion more on defence every year from 2027. Last year, the government spent £53.9 billion on defence. The Prime Minister also said he would cut the foreign aid budget to fund the military boost, a move welcomed by the Conservatives as well as Donald Trump's US administration, but labelled as a betrayal by development charities. The UK currently spends 0.5% on foreign aid. This will be reduced to 0.3% to pay for increased defence spending. Labour had previously promised in their election manifesto to increase spending on foreign aid to 0.7%. This week's spending announcement came as leaders across Europe look to overhaul their defence policies over fears the US could make a deal with Russia to end the Ukraine war, which could leave the continent vulnerable. Well, Sir Keir Starmer is in Washington today, where Ukraine will be top of the agenda in his meeting with President Donald Trump. Ali, I think most people suspected defence spending would have to increase, and I think actually there was pretty much cross-party consensus on that. But what did you see this cut to foreign aid coming to fund that? And surely this is a false narrative, right? That by cutting foreign aid, you can make the UK stronger and better protected, when we know that foreign aid has such an important influence on our soft power, but also on keeping other countries secure.
Yeah, so I'm really glad the way that you've phrased the question is the perfect way to look at this, because the Prime Minister and a lot of commentators has presented this with sort of a hard choice was made between the country's security versus, in essence, it's kind of seen as charity that the UK government gives around the world. And it's kind of presented as that charity starts at home, so we have to look after our own defence before we can give it. That's absolutely a really amateur way at looking at foreign aid. So foreign aid is never given out of the goodness of any country's hearts. I think people kind of understand that that's not how governments work. And very rarely do governments just make sort of just goodwill gestures to other countries from their own budget. The reason that we have foreign aid is because of exactly what you said. It is vital to the UK's soft power around the world. And what do you mean by soft power? So the term soft power means having influence on other countries without using your military or without using things like sanctions and sort of hard power, if you will. So, for example, part of the center for part of the US, the UK's aid program are things like Hearts and Mind projects in areas of the world where there's been conflict, particularly where British troops are deployed to keep them safe. To stop sort of radicalization and other things. A large part of the aid program is about making sure states don't fall into civil war, into conflict, into becoming failed states. All of this keeps Britain safer because it first of all undo some of the damage that we've done around the world, but it also means that we can use non-military means to keep the world a safer place. And so this presentation of our security versus charity is entirely the wrong way to look at foreign aid. I've also looked up where some of this money is going and comes from, which I'm sure we'll kind of talk about in
I think second. What's really interesting about foreign aid is it seems like a politically convenient thing to attack, in terms of if you look at the government finances in this serious some way, where in order to fund something you have to take money from somewhere else, which we can get into all the reasons why that's a false narrative. But if you buy that kind of idea that, you know, the government's budget is like a credit card and there's only a certain amount of money and you have to borrow and you have to manage your finances like a household,
which is nonsense.
But what is really interesting about foreign aid is it actually kind of had political consensus for a long time. Maybe not amongst the public. The public have always sort of perceived foreign aid as almost like a begging bowl. You know, it's like countries that are not as developed as the UK go with a kind of begging bowl and they say, please, can we have some money because we want to build a
That's not what happens.
And it's a very reductive view of foreign aid. But actually, even conservatives have made pretty strong arguments for foreign aid. So there is the left-wing argument that you kind of set out, which is actually the UK has inflicted quite a lot of damage on the rest of the world. It's almost, you could even see it almost as reparations. You know, this is money we pay to help rebuild the communities we've damaged. Then you have the kind of more centrist, global, cosmopolitan argument for foreign aid, which is making you stronger, this country stronger, keeps us stronger. We are all citizens of the world. Pandemics spread. Vaccinations help all of us. You know, preventing the global climate crisis helps all of us. So it's all in our interest. And then you have the conservative argument for foreign aid that is actually, it's a way of enhancing Britain's power.
Yep.
So when you give money to countries, you can influence their political agendas. And actually, we've seen that, you know, the US has cut back on its foreign aid. It had the PEPFAR initiative, which was combating HIV in Africa. This is one of the things that Donald Trump has cut back on. He's cut back on foreign aid and health initiatives. Now, this gives space to countries like Russia and China, the very countries that we are trying to defend against by increasing our defense budget. It gives them space to go into those countries, go into Africa and say, what loans would you like? What infrastructure projects can we help you build? Therefore, buying up their international influence. So it is an extraordinary decision and an extraordinary bit of political framing that that Keir Starmer is making the country safer by slashing the foreign aid budget. He isn't. It's morally objectionable, but in terms of our national security, it also makes no sense.
I think you've articulated it so well. That is pretty much it.
Yeah.
One of the things that Elon Musk did when he came in, which he kind of joked about in the cabinet meeting, was one of the first things that Doge cut was Ebola outbreak money.
I still can't get over Doge.
Yeah. They're aiming to save like $1 trillion or something. But so there's the element of like pandemics and other things which we have very good experience with now after COVID, but it is very much in that if the UK and the US take a step back in their sort of soft power influence in, say, the Middle East or Africa or East Asia, we know who's going to step in.
Yeah,
it's going to be China and it's going to be Russia. Any dreams that this is a sort of helps our safety and security around the world, I think, is dreaming. By the way, and it's while there is cross-party consensus in terms of the leadership, there isn't within the actual rank and file of Labour MPs. And also, one of the big criticisms this week has come from David Miliband, who works in this area.
Remember him?
Yeah, he's a blast from the past, but he's by no means a lefty. Mm. And he was pretty scathing in his criticisms of this. Can I just talk about what this means in real terms, I think, this cut? So if we look at the Centre for Global Development, where they say a lot of this money goes into is the African Development Fund, mm-hmm. again, which has a sort of huge influence on the world as the sort of pivot to Africa happens, if analysts are to be believed. But also the Green Climate Fund and a lot of the green energy stuff is hugely important. And I think we're going to talk next about asylum cases. Mm. And a lot of this work is, again, not out of the goodness of their hearts. It's to stop the transfer and movement of people as a result of war, as a result of famine, but also the next generation is as a result of climate change. Mm. As areas of the world become uninhabitable, people will move. And a lot of this funding is to provide them other places to go other than the UK. So it's really, really funny that the saviour of Western civilization, Kemi Badenoch, as she was called in PMQs, is both anti more asylum seekers, but also anti more foreign aid.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, from one politically charged issue to another.
The Independent Office of National Statistics has conducted vital work on the state of immigration and found the previous government were running an open borders experiment. As the ONS sets out, nearly 1 million people came to Britain in the year ending June 2023. That is four times the migration levels compared with 2019. Time and again, the Conservative Party promised they would get the numbers down. Time and again, they failed.
That was Keir Starmer speaking in November last year. Well, the number of people claiming asylum in the UK in 2024 reached its highest levels since records began back in 1979, according to official Home Office figures. According to data published today, 108,138 people claimed asylum in the year to December 2024, an increase of 18% on 2023, and almost twice the number of 2021. The Home Office said the previous peak recorded was in 2002. The new high follows an uptick in recorded small boats arrivals in recent years. The number of small boats arrivals also increased in 2024, 25% higher than in 2023, although this figure was 20% lower than in 2022. There's also been a sharp increase in people granted citizenship, with the figure standing at more than 269,600 in 2024. The UK now receives the fifth largest number of asylum seekers in Europe, at a time when the government is under pressure to cut the asylum decision backlog. Ali, how bad are the optics of these numbers for Labour?
It's only bad because of where Labour have placed themselves. First of all, in the sort of audio intro I heard, I think the Prime Minister referred to the previous government running an open border policy. Whenever someone says the term, a politician says the term open borders policy, you can be sure that the next phrase out of their mouth is absolute nonsense. No government has ever run an open door policy in the UK. The reality is that these asylum claims are directly linked. And I wonder if, I mean, I haven't done it, but I wonder how much of this is influenced, for example, by Ukraine and the uptake in sort of destabilizations of states and wars, because that's always where asylum seekers tend to come from, conflict regions, as well as now, I hate to sort of bang on the point, but we are going to see a sharp rise in climate asylum seekers. Mm. That is something that we're going to have to deal with unless we deal with the issue of climate change. I'll give you a perfect example of this. The records that we have of Pakistan, large areas of Pakistan, the heats have reached such stages in certain parts of the year that the land is simply uninhabitable for human life. That is the sort of trajectory that the world is headed on. And when that happens, people move, and climate asylum seekers are going to be a huge part of this. I think that's starting to happen now. And so, again, I think there's going to be a huge discussion and conversation over the coming years about climate deniers who are also very anti-asylum seeker, because you either deal with one problem or the other. You can't.
We're already seeing that play out in reform, right? Basically, seeing kind of increasing, creeping narrative of climate denialism. Yeah.
But it's also, people speak from both sides of their mouth. For example, they're very in favour of us sending our military, sort of our weapons into Gaza, for example, to cause, and are very pro the transfer of people out of Gaza, but then we'll be very anti-asylum seekers when people come here. A lot of times people ask, you know, why are we the fifth largest number of asylum seekers in Europe when people have to travel through lots of safe countries to get here? It's because we're an English-speaking language country and lots of asylum seekers speak English.
I just want to make a point on this bit here that said that there is a sharp increase in people granted citizenship, with the figure standing at more than 269,600 in 2024. I mean, arguably, that is a sign of Labour actually bolstering through the asylum system, which the government, the previous Conservative government, completely deliberately ignored and sat on. Labour is making it their mission to get through it, and that is the correct thing to do, because the quicker you process people's claims, the quicker you find out if they are genuine asylum seekers or they are here and they don't have a right to be. So, unfortunately, that is the kind of sharp reality of proper grown up policy making. Is that sometimes things are going to happen, like you're going to see an increase in the number of people granted citizenship. It means you're doing the right thing, but the right wing papers will throw it at you as an example of you doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, can I also make an argument that politicians won't often have the courage to make? This is a good thing. Our country is in desperate need of working age people. It's desperate need of productivity, and a lot of these people are doctors and nurses who've been trained in their home countries, and there's going to need to be additional training. But with the aging population that we have in the UK, immigration is a good thing. It helps our economy. Every expert agrees that immigration, as long as it's done in the right way, helps our country. So the problem is that the space in our politics is colonized now entirely by anti-immigrant. I mean, which party is pro-immigration now? The Labour Party is anti-immigration, the Conservative Party is anti-immigration, and Reform is anti-immigration, and no one cares what the Liberal Democrats have to say.
Okay, well, that is the week unwrapped. Coming up, the Prime Minister is in Washington today for his first official meeting with US President Donald Trump amidst high tensions around, among other things, Ukraine, defence spending, the US cozying up to Russia, and threatening tariffs on its allies. The world certainly isn't quite the same place as it was last year. So what must Keir Starmer get out of his visit, and what would make it a success or a failure? Well, we'll discuss all of that next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair, but listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly, won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours out, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Okay, now to Washington, where the Prime Minister was speaking last night.
Look, it really is a pleasure to be here and to see that the United Kingdom has such a fantastic group of friends here in Washington. And of course, I'm here to meet another close friend of the United Kingdom, President Trump. And my message is really simple, that there is no more important relationship for the United Kingdom. In defence, in security, in trade, in tech, in finance, and so much more. We have an incredible $1.5 trillion invested in each other's economies. Our trading relationship is not just strong, it's fair and balanced. And we work together to create amazing things like the internet or the jet engine. But most of all, and this is really the bedrock of that relationship, we share fundamental values of openness, of democracy, freedom of speech, freedom to thrive, and freedom to pursue the future. A freedom which, this week, we've shown our willingness to defend, with the biggest sustained increase in our defence spending since the Cold War. And look, it wasn't just a joke at the beginning. There is a real buzz, I think, in Washington right now, and it comes from that freedom to pursue the future, the excitement and possibility that this era holds for technology, for artificial intelligence, most of all, which will be transformative, you know that. And this is what makes America great. All around the world, we look at this nation, we admire your ability to keep those eyes fixed on the frontier, the opportunities for a better future. So we want to strike a new partnership. We share the view that our best days lie ahead. And, you know, taking out a chainsaw isn't quite my style. But we are stripping away red tape and bureaucracy. We are reforming permitting, getting things built, reducing barriers to investment and growth. And we're open for business, open for investment. And we're determined to help US innovators thrive in the United Kingdom. So my message is we want to work with you, we want to welcome you to Britain, we want a new partnership, because our history shows that when we work together, great things happen.
That was Sir Keir Starmer speaking at a reception at the UK Embassy in Washington last night. The Prime Minister is meeting Donald Trump today in his first official meeting with the US President. On the agenda will be the economy, borders, national security, AI and space. That's a very crowded list of things to discuss. But of course, the PM wants closer cooperation with the US in all fields. Yesterday, Starmer met with the CEOs of large US businesses in a bid to showcase the UK's offer for investors. But most pressingly, and top of the PM's agenda, is of course the issue of Ukraine. The government wants a guarantee from the US that they will continue to defend Ukraine against any future Russian aggression. Ahead of the trip to Washington, the Prime Minister pledged to increase UK defence spending, as we've discussed, a key ask of all NATO members by President Trump, and reiterated his commitment to putting British boots on the ground in Ukraine as he attempts to lower tensions between Europe and the US and demonstrate to President Trump that the UK is willing to play its part. But even before Sir Keir Starmer arrived in Washington, the choreography of the trip hit a little turbulence as President Trump appeared to pour cold water on the prospect of a US military backstop for Ukraine as part of any peace deal. Here he is speaking about a mineral the US will sign with Ukraine tomorrow that doesn't include any security guarantees.
The other thing that we don't like is that Europe has spent $100 billion, we've spent $350 billion. Europe gets their money back because they spent it in the form of a loan, and we just gave them, whether it's $300 or $350 billion, nobody really knows. They can't even tell me the answer to that, but it means probably more than that. So what we're doing is now we're saying, look, we want to be secured, we want to get that money back. We're helping a country through a very, very big problem, a problem like very few people have had. Shouldn't have had this problem because it shouldn't have happened, but it did happen, so we have to straighten it out. But the American taxpayer now is going to get their money back plus.
Mr. President, yesterday with Emmanuel Macron, you said you had spoken to Putin about the idea of peacekeepers in Ukraine, that Putin was fine with it. The Kremlin, I guess, has said that that's actually unacceptable to them.
That's not what I was told. But you're going to need some form of peacekeeping, so something will be done that's going to be satisfactory to everybody. We need peacekeeping, too.
Any situation?
It's actually something I did discuss, but a form of peacekeeping that's acceptable to everybody. Ultimately, we'll be able to agree on something.
That was President Trump speaking from the Oval Office yesterday. The president said earlier in his administration's first cabinet meeting that, quote, I'm not going to make security guarantees beyond very much. We're going to have Europe do that because Europe is the next door neighbour. Well, speaking to reporters ahead of his White House meeting with Donald Trump today, Sir Keir Starmer insisted that the UK was working in lockstep with the president on the matter of Ukraine. Asked if he could trust President Trump in light of what happened in recent weeks, the Prime Minister replied, yes, I've got a good relationship with him, Sir Keir said. He continued, as you know, I've met him, I've spoken to him on the phone, and this relationship between our two countries is a special relationship with a long history, forged as we fought wars together, as we traded together. And as I say, I want it to go from strength to strength. I've been absolutely resolute that we're not going to choose between one side of the Atlantic or the other. We will work with the US, we will work with our European allies. That's what we've done for decades, and it's what we'll do whilst I'm Prime Minister. OK, Ali, let's start with Ukraine because it's on top of Starmer's agenda. It's obviously a geopolitical mess and the PM is walking straight into the belly of the beast to try and get commitments from the US that they have already said they probably won't give. He's positioned the UK as the sort of mediator between the US and the EU. But, I mean, how much can he actually do? Does the UK really have influence? I mean, we're kind of talking about the UK as if it has the ear of the EU and the US. In some ways, we can mediate a bridge. But Donald Trump is, you know, absolutely difficult to pin down. He could go any which way. And we've done a lot to piss off the EU over the past decade. So what can Keir Starmer walk away with today that would mean that we have got something successful?
Yeah, first of all, we don't have the ear of either. I don't think we particularly have.
Is that true? I mean, we do to some extent probably have the ear of the EU
more so than Donald Trump. Yeah. Considering that Donald Trump, when this trip was initially proposed, did two things. First, he said Keir Starmer has invited himself to the White House, which he said in one of his press corps meetings. And then on the backstop, kind of like you said, poured complete cold water on whether the US would accept that.
It's never good when you're going around to someone's house and they
said that they've invited themselves. Yeah, it's and it is literally his house. So yeah, that's look, this is entirely on Ukraine. I actually think, funnily enough, I think the last sort of 2 weeks following Donald Trump's meeting with the Russians in Saudi Arabia, not his physical presence, but the team's meeting with the Russians, I think it's when Starmer has looked strongest, because he pushed back a little bit, more so than I expected, in terms of the necessity for Ukrainians to determine their own future and sovereignty, the fact that Europe will be steadfast in its support for Ukraine, even when the American support seemed to falter. We had the interview last week with the Ukrainian MP. So I thought that, as ever, Donald Trump responds to strength, and that was sort of the road that Starmer was going down. And I thought it's the strongest that the PM has looked since he took office was on the Ukraine stuff following the US's position. In fact, Alistair Campbell, who's the former chief communications chief for Tony Blair, also said the same thing, that you can't just keep saying the word special relationship if it doesn't actually have any tangible meaning. The only issue I think Starmer has had is that Macron was there last week, and he was basically doing the same thing, and actually looked like he walked away stronger for it. There was that moment where he interrupts and corrects the president about who the aggressor is in this case. What would a successful visit for Keir Starmer look like? I mean, I think what he's really looking for is the American assurance, that backstop, which I don't think he'll get. The big thing for Europe seems to be, and remember, the European parties all met prior to this, I think in Paris. They want absolute assurances that there won't be a re-invasion of Ukraine if the peace deal was agreed. So I think Starmer faces a very, very difficult test, particularly given I don't think Trump likes him very much. I don't think the election stuff helped when that story broke of Labour officials and sort of activists going out to America. I don't think Trump has taken too kindly, and he's definitely the type of politician that will remember some of the tweets and some of the things that were said about Trump while senior Labour officials were in opposition. The real risk, I think, for Keir Starmer is when they do the joint press conference. And this is what I want to ask you, because Donald Trump is, you know, unpredictable at the best of times, and you never know what he's going to say, even with other world leaders in the room. And he could, what do the kids call it, little bro, Keir Starmer pretty hard in that press conference,
like in Love Actually. Have you seen Love Actually? I bet you haven't, have you? Because it's a cultural zeitgeist thing that you obviously haven't seen.
Which one? So but you asked me who Superman was before we came on air.
Was the actor. Okay. I know who Superman is. Okay, in Love Actually, Hugh Grant is playing the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
There's a really famous scene. I don't know who it is who plays the US President, but it's a really famous scene where the US President is doing that. He's being like smarmy and sleazy in a joint press conference, and Hugh Grant stands up to him and says, actually, you're not going to bully us. And it's quite a famous scene, right? Yeah. Keir Starmer is not Hugh Grant.
No.
No. He's not a natural leader. What he is very good at doing, and I will give him his credit, is building a case for something, making the evidence very, very clear, getting to a line of thought, making an argument.
But that's not how Trump works.
Yeah. Exactly. So he's... Yeah. But it worked quite well against Boris Johnson, who is fairly kind of similar to Trump. The difference is that those two were kind of equals in terms that they were both going for the prime ministerial position. Boris Johnson was prime minister, Keir Starmer was against him in the House of Commons, and they were kind of working on the same territory. You're right, here we have Keir Starmer in Washington. The US holds the Trump card. And therefore, you know, Keir Starmer can present himself as logical and loyally, but that doesn't work against the ramblings of a madman that Donald Trump likes.
Well, okay, let me paint a picture for you, right? Let's say, and I think any second now, they're going to be in the Oval Office together. Mm. I want to get your thoughts on how much damage you think this would do. Let's say they're sat in the Oval Office and Keir Starmer talks about the importance of a US backstop, the importance of Ukraine being part of the negotiations and sort of land not being given to Russia and Russia being the aggressor, all the typical lines of the pro-Ukrainian sort of the reality of what's happened in this war. If Donald Trump comes back hard on him and says, well, that's not going to happen, Europe hasn't been pulling its own weight, we're tired of US sort of protecting you guys, really, again, little broing Keir Starmer, and then he comes home having not won anything really and made to look a little bit of a powerless mug in the Oval Office, how much damage does that do to him politically here, given that in the polls, the person stood right opposite him seems to be someone very close to Donald Trump? Do you think it does any political damage?
I actually don't think it will do that much damage to Keir Starmer. Mm. I think it presents an opportunity for other leaders Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage to attack him. But they, the public do not side with them. They do not like Donald Trump.
No, they don't. And actually, this is a misconception, by the way. People, I don't know why. There seems to be a theory that the British public like Donald Trump, and the polling suggests that's not true.
They don't like Donald Trump. They don't like his surrogates who attempt to interfere in British democracy, a la Elon Musk. They don't really like the cultural American...
The brashness
of the presidency, especially in Donald Trump's form. And they support Ukraine. And increasingly, they want to move closer to Europe. So it could present vulnerabilities for Keir Starmer in terms of people attacking his characteristics as a leader. But do I think it puts...
Could it make it look weak? And then I want to present the question in a different
way. I think it makes him look weaker if he comes out... gleaming about Donald Trump and acting like Donald Trump is a very trustworthy person and they've made an ironclad deal, because I wouldn't trust Donald Trump.
Yeah. Okay, so let me ask you a different way. I think Macron came out of the meeting with Trump looking pretty good because there was that moment, and politics is all about these sort of these optical moments where he grabs Donald Trump by the hand when I think it's the moment where Trump suggests that Russia isn't the aggressor in the war.
It was about how much money had been
It was about whether there were loans, like whether the Europe was going to get its money back from Ukraine and America wasn't. And he grabs Donald Trump by the arm and corrects him, and Donald Trump kind of takes it. And I think that was a really strong moment for Macron, because he looked like he was standing up to... Do you think that Keir Starmer's team will have worked in something like that? Because I think that could make him look quite strong.
I think the UK is more vulnerable than... I think Keir Starmer's more... Because they don't have the EU behind them in the same way France does. However, I think... There needs to be a healthy dose of scepticism in anything that Keir Starmer says, because I think the worst outcome would be acting very elated at the prospect of a deal and that deal crumbling. Yeah. And you know, I can imagine that Trump will have factored in a number of clauses or
If I was like the communications director at Number 10, I'd be bricking it right now about what's going to happen in this, because you just never know what Trump's going to say.
I want to ask you about this piece in The Guardian, which someone has written. I'm not quite sure who the author is, but it is... it's George Monbiot, so a great kind of left-wing progressive voice. What if Britain has to defend itself from the US? He says this is the question no one dares to ask. He talks about the fact that we know that Donald Trump could clear the path for Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. He will actively assist them. We know that the US now has an expansionist agenda. At what point do we stop categorizing the US as an ally and start thinking it as a threat? And what he points out in this article very well is all our vulnerabilities that the UK has in terms of what we rely on the US for. So that's things like intelligence sharing. That's things like our weapons systems. Basically saying, if the US were to turn, you know, against the UK, against the West, and were to become a Russian surrogate or a Russian ally, what does Britain do? Do you think that is a question that we're not actually talking about enough? Or do you think that is a bit alarmist?
I think it's a little bit alarmist, but bear in mind that the US voted with Russia for the first time in a long time. Certainly my memory, I might be getting this wrong. I'm sure producers will correct us if not. But they voted with Russia at the United Nations Security Council on the motion of Russia being the aggressor in Ukraine. We abstained, surprisingly. But I've not seen the US vote with Russia on such a substantive motion at the Security Council in a long time. So I don't... Look, I think it's alarmist in terms of whether the UK would have to defend itself against an American attack. I mean, the answer to the question you presented is very, very easy and simple. What would happen if the UK, Britain, has to defend itself from the US? The answer is we're toast.
We're toast. And this is the important point that George Monbiot makes, which is... We are so entangled...
By the way, it makes Brexit look so much more ludicrous.
We are so entangled with the US because of our weapon systems, our intelligence sharing, everything defence we have gotten into bed with the US for. Unlike France, who disentangled themselves from the US a long time ago, they created an independent military, independent security systems. Does this not make us... actually, ultimately, very, very vulnerable to whatever Donald Trump wants?
Yeah, do you know what? That question that you asked is, I think, an almost an existential question that we have to ask ourselves as a country, because we are now in the state where the US is voting with Russia in the UN Security Council, is meeting with Russia and Saudi Arabia without European partners, is talking about withdrawing its funding in terms of security arrangements with Europe. The question of its involvement with NATO, I mean, how many European partners actually believe that the US would step in if Article 5 were to be triggered? I think that is a question now. And given how absolutely reliant we are as a country on US in terms of intelligence sharing, military protection, also economically, while, by the way, Donald Trump is threatening to put tariffs on us, you know, I think it's a fundamental question we have to ask ourselves is, are we actually a sovereign country, or are we the 51st or 2nd state, depending on if Canada joined?
I mean, it takes me right back to my politics degree, which did a lot of international relations theory. This is proper IR theory. This is realism, you know, 101. What do you do? I've just got word from the producer that Keir Starmer has arrived at the White House for talks with US President Donald Trump. So we will bring you updates as we go along.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Okay, coming up, Andrew Tate, who is currently flying back from detention in Romania to the US amid a multitude of sexual assault and human trafficking allegations, has hit the news once again. The UK government had previously requested his extradition. Just how dangerous is this man to impressionable young men? And what message does his return to the US send to these people? All that and more next.
FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. It won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
And we've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Politics Uncensored on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan have fled Romania for the US on a private jet after Donald Trump's administration demanded the lifting of a travel ban on the controversial influencers. Andrew, 38, and Tristan, 36, both UK-US nationals who grew up in Luton, are facing human trafficking and sexual abuse charges in Bucharest and in Britain. But Romania gave in to US pressure to return the brothers' passports and has granted them permission to travel, which has led to victims' fears that they will never face justice. Today, the plane believed to be carrying the self-styled king of toxic masculinity was the most tracked in the world on Flight Radar 24, a popular flight tracking website. In Britain, four of the alleged victims called on the Prime Minister to challenge the Trump administration on his visit to Washington and said they were re-traumatised by their, quote, escape from justice. The Tates were barred from leaving Romania while under investigation for trafficking women, including minors, across Romania, the UK and the US. The Romanian Special Prosecutor's Service said the case against the brothers had not been dropped and that if Tates missed any court hearing, they would face a high measure of deprivation of liberty, although how that might be achieved with the brothers not in Romania is, of course, uncertain. The next hearing is at the end of March. Last March, a court in Bucharest said the Tates, who are vocal Trump supporters, could be extradited to the UK, but only once the Romanian cases have been concluded. It now looks unlikely, given the US position on extraditing its own citizens, that this would not be possible. Ali, of course, there are open proceedings against these men in multiple countries. When it comes to their online influence, what does their return to America mean? I mean, surely this is going to bolster them. What does this say to impressionable young men who followed them before and will continue to follow them now?
I mean, look, I think first of all, the more alarming question is, what does this say to women and to victims, or their victims, but also victims of similar crimes for which
they're alleged victims.
Alleged victims, yeah. And victims of these sorts of crimes which have been alleged on them across the world, because essentially what they'll be looking at is two men who have a huge online influence, who say some of the most disgusting things online and spout off some of the, I think, most dangerous sort of ideas and narratives in the online space, that they've essentially been able to travel to the US while they're still under investigation in multiple countries. And it's not just Romania, I should say, that they're also under investigation here in the UK as well. And I think that investigation is ongoing. What's really interesting in this case is that the Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, has said that they're not welcome. I think his quote is, "We had no involvement in them coming here." His deputy press secretary, Molly Beast, has responded to their arrival and has said, "The reality is Florida is not a place where you are welcome with that type of conduct in the air." That is DeSantis. "I don't know how it came to this. I found out through the media that this was something that was happening." So even Ron DeSantis, who is not, I think, the most sort of liberal of politicians, in fact, he's quite far to the right, isn't welcoming Tristan or Andrew Tate into Florida.
Why do we think that the US might, or somebody in the US, or some people within the US government might give refuge to the Tate brothers? Talk us through what is going on here,
Yeah, there are allegations that he actually, like you said in your intro, he's been quite a vocal supporter of Donald Trump, who's now the president, and there are allegations that he has relationships with people who are linked to the president. Obviously, we don't have any evidence, and so, I don't think anything's come out that's how he's gotten to America.
I'm just going to say, when Trump won the US election, Andrew Tate posted, "The patriarchy is back," on social media and said, "Women should not be allowed to vote."
He just said that. He said the quiet part out loud.
Yeah.
I mean, look, so the bigger worry is, like, I guess, how can I say this? The sort of narratives that Andrew Tate is now running is just open sort of misogyny and hatred of women, and I don't understand how the radicalization he does of young impressionable men, like you've said, often sort of, I think boys between the age of like 12 to 15 are very often are quite vulnerable to him. Mm. He's radicalizing them online and is under investigation in multiple countries. So I think it's really disheartening that he's been able to bounce from Romania into Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, I think we have a clip actually of Andrew Tate speaking and his brother speaking after having landed in the US just now. Here it is.
And our prosecutor recently decided, because we have no active indictment in court, to let us go and return. This is a democratic society. It's supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, as my brother and I are. And I think it's extremely important that we stop allowing media spin, wrap-up smears, lies, or carefully constructed narratives from George Soros-funded operations trying to destroy the reputations of good people who have no intention to do anything other than follow the law.
You can't convince me that accent's real.
No. I mean, also, if if innocent till proven guilty, then
prove yourself.
Prove
innocent.
Yourself. Yeah, I know. There's something really interesting in here about the links between the Tate brothers and the Trump administration, right? So, J.D. Vance has appeared on a pro-Tate podcast. I don't know who did that. Elon Musk has responded to a suggestion from Tate that he would run for Prime Minister of the UK, saying he's not wrong. So he has backed Tate's provisional suggestion that he might run for Prime Minister. One of Tate's lawyers, Paul Ingrassia, is the White House liaison official for the US Department of Justice. So there are these links here. But it is very interesting to me that Ron DeSantis... Mm-hmm. did not know about this. Very interesting indeed. I wonder what you also make of the fact that Mr. Musk and J.D. Vance, who is, of course, the U.S. vice president, criticized Romania after the police detained the far-right presidential frontrunner during the Romanian election. I mean, it feels, again, a little bit like Musk interfering in other political systems and other countries' affairs.
Yeah, and look, I mean, I guess I keep coming back to, I don't know, I can't speak to the actual allegations and the investigation in Romania because I don't know how the Romanian legal system works. Mm. And I can't speak to the allegations that are being investigated in the UK other than to say they are obviously extremely serious because it's allegedly to do with human trafficking as part of it as well. So all we can say is these sort of allegations and investigations of the most serious kind. Mm. What I will say about Andrew Tate and his brother now going to Florida is two things. One, for women all across the Western world specifically, but all across the world, what does it say to them that someone can be accused and investigated and put in prison for a period of time and investigated in multiple countries of crimes, including allegations of rape and human trafficking, and they can continue their online platform in such a way, they can fly over to America and be embraced by a president who himself has allegations of sexual misconduct, who can go on all these podcasts where they spout really dangerous, disgusting, hateful rhetoric of women, who is now at a space where society has allowed him to proudly say the patriarchy is back and women shouldn't be able to vote. What message does that send to women all across our society who face these sort of very serious crimes day to day, who feel like they can't report it to the police, who feel like the political system doesn't take it seriously? It just reaffirms that those things are true. And you can only imagine victims of these alleged crimes, not just by the Tate brothers, who are under investigation, having proven and professed their innocence, but who face these sort of crimes elsewhere in society, who now would kind of go back and go, no one is looking out for me. Mm. Not the political system, which is led by Donald Trump in America, one of the most richest men in the world, Elon Musk, to these two Tate clowns who've been able to run from Romania to the US, and then impressionable young men who themselves face identity crisis will think that they can get away with this sort of behavior, not the crimes, but the rhetoric, absolutely scot-free, and then jump on a private plane, who knows where that money came from, and fly to the US. So I think, I don't know, man. I think it sends a really dangerous message about where our society is. And I don't, not even just about their allegations, but everything from Elon to Andrew Tate to Donald Trump.
Mm. And maybe he wasn't wrong when he said despair. The patriarchy is back.
No, I mean, he said it and every evidence points to that being true. What do you think?
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, We saw it throughout Donald Trump's campaign. He campaigned on a basis of misogyny, and it would make sense to me that somehow Andrew Tate would get tangled up in this because he has always been a loyal Trump supporter, and that's what Trump favours.
Yeah, you know what my favourite sort of Andrew Tate narrative online has been over the last couple of years? His thing that being bold is by choice, because after he went to prison, we saw that receding hairline. Anyway, fuck you, Andrew Tate, and that is Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me, Ali Milani, UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
We're going to miss Zoe next week. If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.